MacCast, Sunday, January 11th, 2015. This episode of the MacCast is brought to you by lynda.com. You can get a free 10-day trial of lynda.com's outstanding video courses by going to lynda.com/MacCast. And by Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we've got quite an episode lined up for you today. Lots of things to talk about. We are going to get into some of Apple's new products, some of the latest rumors about what Apple's going to be up to in 2015. I guess that makes sense, starting out a new year. We're also going to take a look back at a technology that we seem to have forgotten about a little bit. Remember iBeacons? We're going to get into that. We're also going to talk about the Apple Watch, some new rumors and a potential release date now being tossed around. Also, we're going to look at new 12-inch product offerings from Apple, or rumored 12-inch product offerings. A lot of rumors in this episode. The iPad Pro and also the possible 12-inch Retina MacBook Air. We got updates to that. And Spotlight might be revealing a little bit more about your email than you might like. We're going to get into that and get to some feedback. I got some updates from the last episode. iCloud Photo app seems to have made a reappearance. I'm also going to talk about HomeKit, lots of HomeKit information coming out of CES this past week, and I'm excited about that, as you'll hear. Also, some hints and tips and tricks. Some of you need some help finding missing disk space. We've got a question about iTunes and how to find specific content. And, of course, the new segment to the MacCast, My Thing of the Moment. We're going to get into all of that and more in this episode. Stay tuned for that. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is lynda.com. You know, lynda.com is the place to go for high-quality video training. They have almost 6,000 courses that are taught by industry experts, and they have more added weekly, so constantly growing their library. And their courses cover all skill levels, whether you're advanced and you're wanting to expand your skills, or you're someone who's just starting out wanting to learn a new technology or a new skill and trying to get up to speed. They have tutorials for you. And it's a new year, so now's a perfect time to maybe pick up a new skill or expand your knowledge. And lynda.com just has a plethora of courses to choose from. Take, for example, Eric. Eric emailed me to say he's been taking advantage of lynda.com to help learn Objective-C and iOS development. And what's great is once you're in the lynda.com system, you have access to all of their training. So you might start out wanting to learn a programming language or iOS development, but that's not the whole pie, right? You then have to know about design for your app. So they have great graphics courses. You can take a design course like creating icons with Illustrator, or once you have your app ready to go, what about distribution? What about getting it in the App Store? Well, guess what? There's a course on distributing iOS applications through the App Store. So, Eric, that means you're going to be able to not only have a great-looking app, but you're also going to be able to get help putting it out there and giving it to the world. So lynda.com has all that, a lot more courses on photography, on music, on video production. Take a look. They also have a mobile application for your Apple and Android devices, so you can learn anytime, anywhere. And their premium plans will let you download project files so you can practice along with the instructors. And you get all access to lynda.com starting at one low monthly price of $25. That gives you the entire lynda.com library. And best of all, MacCast listeners can get a free trial so you can check out all the courses, see what's available. And all you have to do is go to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast to try it out. I really think you're going to love it. So please head there, lynda.com/MacCast, and sign up. And a big thank you to lynda.com for their support of the MacCast. So remember all the excitement around iBeacons? And I just noticed I have in my show notes iBeacons. I would love some iBeacons, but we're going to talk about iBeacons, rather. We haven't heard too much about them lately, or even since Apple announced them at WWDC. For those of you who don't know what an iBeacon is, iBeacons are Apple's marketing term for little low-cost, low-energy Bluetooth transmitters that enable your smartphones or other devices to perform actions when they come within close proximity to a beacon. A lot of people like to refer to it almost as indoor positioning systems. So you have, you know, global positioning systems like GPS. This is more for smaller spaces. So you walk into a retail location. If an iBeacon was enabled at a display, as you approach that display, if you had the app for that store, it could pop up automatically a notification with maybe additional information about the product, maybe a coupon, a discount offer, something like that. And so iBeacons have been rolled out and deployed in some retail locations, including Apple's retail stores. I've also played around with some iBeacons. I used the Blue Series 100 beacons from Two Canoes. And Two Canoes actually has a little application called GeoHopper that allows you to script different actions on your Mac. So when you come within range of your own beacons, you can have it do various things, maybe turn on some lights or perform some sort of action, send a text message maybe when you leave the house to let your family know that you've gone, those sorts of things. And those are the kinds of things that you can do with iBeacons. And several companies make iBeacons, but this week there was an FCC filing that seems to indicate Apple might be building their own as well. 9to5 Mac has actually been keeping an eye on an Apple registration with the FCC for a new piece of iBeacon Bluetooth hardware. And that was recently updated to include a manual. So I guess this has been around for a little while. They've been watching it. And it now has some additional details about what this thing is. It's a little device. It mounts to a wall with a standard screw. It has a couple LED status indicators on it for battery life. They don't state how long the battery or how much battery life it's going to have, but typically beacons last several months, so we can expect months of battery life. The battery is actually charged by a little micro USB connector that's on the device, and there's a little slide switch on it to power it on and off and also place it into a configuration mode to interact with an Apple app. They also, in the document, mention an iBeacon app, and you'd be able to configure and set it up. I'm assuming the power range, because the way you kind of control how close these work in terms of proximity is by adjusting the power range of the beacon, basically how far out the signal can go. And it's not clear at this point if this beacon is something that's targeted at consumers, if it's targeted at retailers or maybe developers for helping them develop iBeacon technology in their own apps, or maybe it's just something for Apple's own retail stores. It's really not clear. It's not clear if it'll ever be available commercially, but interesting nonetheless, because we haven't heard about iBeacons in a while, and it now looks like Apple might be building their own product. It could be something, I would imagine, that might tie into HomeKit as well, or could be useful if tied into HomeKit, and we'll be talking about HomeKit a little bit later in this episode, but just an interesting update on iBeacons. Another really interesting update, or series of updates that have been going on over the past week, is the rumored release date of the Apple Watch. About a week ago, things got a little bit exciting when Apple pushed some updates to their Apple Watch pages in Europe and a few other countries. They seemingly changed the text on the Apple Watch page, which said the Apple Watch would be available in 2015, to available in early 2015, although those changes, once they were sort of reported on, were quickly rolled back. So who knows how or why that slipped up or slipped out there. But still, there might be some truth in that early statement, I guess, depending on your definition of early. If you remember, too, early 2015 was the timing that Angela Arendt had reportedly mentioned in an address to Apple retail employees. So there's been this idea that we might see it sometime earlier in 2015. And I know it had been rumored a couple times that Apple was shooting for a February launch, although that's not seeming like it's going to be the date. This time around, 9to5 Mac says their sources are telling them that the Apple Watch will make an appearance in March. And they're basing this on rumors that select Apple retail employees are going to be sent to an extensive training program on the Apple Watch in February. The program's supposed to happen between February 9th and February 16th, either in Cupertino or in Austin, Texas. They weren't really sure on that. And the employees that are getting sent to this training are supposed to go there. They're going to get the corporate training from Apple, and then they're supposed to return back to their local and regional Apple retail stores and then train the additional employees for a launch later in the month, or in March, rather. And 9to5 is also reporting that Apple has been polishing up the iWatch OS and putting kind of some of the finishing touches, specifically focusing on the device's battery life and doing some extensive testing there. As far as we know, Tim Cook kind of alluded that it would have about a one-day battery life. We would hope that Apple could maybe push that a little further. Maybe they can do some tweaking in the software. They're also supposedly putting some polish on the inductive charging mechanism, because if you are going to have to charge it every day, they need to make sure that that's rock solid and works very easily. But they're also saying there's, at this point, really no hardware changes. So a lot of the stuff that Apple is messing and tweaking around with is going to be software at this point. They're supposedly moving into production, I think, sometime this month or early next month, so that they can meet their launch date and demand and supply. And it's looking like demand is going to be pretty good. As far as lining up and getting all those components together, Digitimes is claiming that Samsung will be supplying the processors for the S1 system in a package design for Apple. The processor is supposedly going to use Samsung's 28-nanometer fabrication process, according to Apple Insider. And they also say that Apple has ordered 4,000 12-inch wafers per month to start stocking up their production lineup. And the S1, if you don't know, that's the heart of the Apple Watch. It is everything on a single chip or in a single package. It's going to contain the processor, the mobile DRAM, the flash storage, also all of the circuitry to control functions like wireless connectivity and the touch input. It's unknown who's supplying the other components for the S1 package, but I would imagine that Samsung could supply some, if not all, of the necessary items. And Advanced Semiconductor Engineering in Taiwan is reportedly handling actually packaging and assembling the S1 modules that will wind up in the final Apple Watch. Now, some analysts are expecting the Apple Watch to account for up to 36% of Apple's revenue growth in 2015. So this is going to be a huge product for Apple in the coming year. And I guess Apple better hurry up, because some cheap Chinese knockoffs already showed up at CES. And get this, they're 1/100th of the price of a real Apple Watch, just $35. There weren't a lot of details. I would imagine this is just a stylized knockoff. I'm not sure that it had any of the functionality of an Apple of an actual Apple Watch in terms of the sensors and things like that. But it was surprisingly close in terms of the design and look to an Apple Watch. So don't be fooled. I don't think anybody's going to be fooled by a cheap Chinese knockoff, but it was just a funny thing that popped up there at CES in that Chinese section. And if you've ever been to CES, what that is you go in there and it's pretty much a bunch of Chinese manufacturers trying to tell people, hey, look, these are the kinds of things that we can build. So they often have flashy or sort of popular items in there that you might want to do. And they basically sell them to you real cheap. I think that's part of the reason why it's a $35 price. So then you're supposed to import them to your country and then turn around and sell them for a profit. So they kind of like OEM these things. You'll see all kinds of funky products and designs, like, you know, USB sticks and cables. And it's just the weirdest place at CES. But interesting, nonetheless, to see that they're already making Apple Watch knockoffs and Apple hasn't even released the product yet. And one other thing that was a little bit concerning this week, actually it was alarming and then turned out to not be so much, isn't that always the case, is a company was claiming that they were going to start putting ads on the Apple Watch. How would you feel about having ads on your Apple Watch? The mobile advertising company TapSense announced that they had a mobile ad platform featuring what they called hyper-local targeting and Apple Pay integration, which also had the ability to push ads to the Apple Watch, or it appeared to be able to push ads to the Apple Watch. And if you're like the rest of the world, and myself included, no one seemed to like this idea. And I would imagine most of all, probably Apple when they heard about it. Now, when the report first dropped, I was reading some of the pieces, and some of the sources expressed concern that that Apple had maybe gone back on its word to protect users' privacy if this sort of thing was allowed, but turned out not to be true. After the proverbial you-know-what hit the fan, TapSense actually turned around and updated their blog post to note that their ad platform SDK and the Apple Watch SDK both are still in beta, and more importantly, they noted that watch-specific app developer guidelines have not been released yet, and that means that very likely their technology could be in violation of any guidelines that Apple might put forth, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say it absolutely would be. They also said that their TapSense SDK will not integrate directly with Apple Pay, but use this sort of barcode or barcode system that would work at point of sale, or they would need to integrate with Passbook to actually have Passbook push a coupon or a barcode to the Apple Watch, because it's something that's not allowed directly. I think they also alluded that they might have a watch face that integrated or featured the technology, and in their follow-up blog post noted that Apple doesn't make that available to developers. Developers can't build their own watch faces yet, so that's not even possible. So it's all kind of speculative. And Apple's iOS APIs and development guidelines specifically prevent advertisers from injecting ads or pop-ups into iOS apps or onto the iOS homepage, or even do it within widgets or notification center, or they basically disallow any way of masquerading ads as system alerts. And that's just a few of the restrictions that they have on iOS. So I think it's only natural to assume that the same is going to be exactly true for the Watch OS. So this is looking like more sort of puffery than anything else that we probably need to be worried about. This week brought possibly our first look at the rumored 12-inch iPad Pro. The site nowhereelse.fr said they received a sketch, really a 3D rendering of Apple's larger screened iPad Pro. And I think rendering or sketch of the iPad Pro is a little bit extreme, because actually when I saw the image, it's just one corner showing the speaker grill located to the side of the lock button and just above the rear camera. So it's really just kind of this little tiny piece of the rumored iPad Pro. And again, it's a 3D rendering or sketch, not the actual casing or device itself. And the source is said to be an employee who works at Foxconn. And the French site claims this same source has been reliable in the past. I think it's supposedly the same source that released some of the sketches of the iPhone 6 to the same website. So there might be a little bit of validity to it. The leaker did also say that initial testing phases for the larger iPad were halted last summer after Apple had received new prototypes. And he wasn't able to provide many details about this sketch in terms of, for example, the actual dimensions, height and width, which is something a lot of us really would like to know about. So he couldn't confirm the 12-inch screen size, but he did say that this new iPad was going to be between 6.99 and 7.5 millimeters thick, and that it would have four speakers, two on the top and two on the bottom. Now, that four speaker rumor, if you remember, is consistent with some of the past rumors we had been hearing about the iPad Pro. It's a little bit of an odd thing. I guess maybe the iPad's going to have more focus on music creation. Thus, Apple wants to integrate a better sound system, something that is actually full stereo in any orientation. The thing about that is that, and I mentioned this on the iOS show, is, and I'm not an expert in audio, so if you are, let me know. But I would imagine on a device, even with a 12-inch screen, you don't have that much distance between the two speakers. So Can you really get that much stereo separation in that sort of system? Does this matter a whole lot? I don't really know. It would seem to me that it wouldn't be that big of a deal whether it's mono or versus stereo. Maybe 12 inches is enough to get that distance. But it always seemed odd to me when, for example, smartphones would say they've got stereo sound or stereo speakers built in. I get it for headphones, but just when you have two speakers that close together, does that sort of thing really work? Let me know if you're an audio person and happen to know. But they were not able to, as I said, to provide details on the screen size, although past rumors have said or pointed to a size between 12.2 inches and 12.9 inches. And also in previous iPad Pro rumors, we had heard that it will come with an updated Apple A8X processor, 2 gigabytes of RAM, and Touch ID. I don't think those upgrades or updates are surprising at all. It's unknown at this point when Apple actually might announce a larger screened iPad or if they will at all, but analyst Ming-Chi Kuo did suggest in the past that the tablet would enter production sometime in the second quarter of 2015 with a release date later in the year. So I'm thinking third quarter, you know, maybe moving into the holiday season. And backing this up a little bit more, supposedly, the Chinese microblog site Weibo reported or posted a picture of what they said was a piece of production tooling equipment for the rumored iPad Pro. Now, once again, the image seems a little bit sketchy at best, according to Apple Insider. They pointed out that the piece looks like it could be for pressing together the two sides of a smart cover. They also said it could be for almost anything, plastic injection mold, a fixture used to just hold parts for or iPads for final finishing and assembly, or it could just be a mold for a lunch tray. Who really knows? And so it just serves as a good reminder that, as always, we can only read so much into these rumors, or I guess we can read a lot into them if we really want. But until Apple actually announces something or makes a move, you know, there's a lot of speculating and just guesswork going on. You know, maybe some educated guesswork, but guesswork nonetheless. And not wanting to be ignored, Apple's other upcoming 12-inch product surfaced this week and had some rumors of its own. I guess it didn't want to get upstaged by the iPad. That's the rumored 12-inch Retina MacBook Air. 9to5Mac claims that they have some new details on the product. They say supposedly the footprint of the device is going to be close to that of the current 11-inch model. It will be narrow, a little bit narrower and a little bit taller, specifically a quarter of an inch narrower and a quarter of an inch taller, to be exact. They said Apple would be able to achieve this by having an edge-to-edge keyboard and moving the speaker grills from the sides up to the top area of the keyboard between the display and the top row of home keys. And then to squeeze that 12-inch display into a form factor more reminiscent of the 11-inch model, they also said that the bezels on the display have been reduced on all sides to kind of get it in there. Now, after 9to5Mac released their report, there were some renderings that showed up online. And the one thing I didn't like about the renderings, well, first of all, the edge-to-edge keyboard seems really unusual, although I kind of think I like the look. So imagine the keys extending out all the way to the edges. I think it was also noted that they kind of spaced the keys closer together. I think that might be an issue for some in terms of touch typing, but, you know, who knows? And the one thing that I didn't like about the renderings was how the speaker grills were presented at the top. They were kind of these four grills along the top edge of the keyboard. And I think design-wise, Apple would be more likely to do something like on the edges of the current MacBook Pros, where that entire space along the top just has a bunch of little perforations or little holes to let the audio through. I don't think it has to be centralized directly above the speaker. I think you could go all the way across and still achieve the sound you want, but have a much more cohesive look, something that isn't broken up. It actually goes all the way across, especially since that keyboard now extends all the way across the width. Why not have that grill sort of extend all the way across? And I know the holes are really small, but maybe even that could help with ventilation. I don't know. Or maybe they can't do that sort of thing because it could deter from ventilation. Not really sure. I guess I'm not a design engineer in terms of making cases for MacBook Pros, but I just didn't visually like the look of the separate speaker grills. The other thing I didn't like was the rumors about the ports that this device would have on it. And as a matter of fact, I think this is where the design gets a little bit sketchy to me. The report claimed that the new 12-inch Retina MacBook Air would only have two ports. And one of those ports is a headphone jack. So that means just one USB Type-C connector to serve for both connectivity and charging. Yeah, not even a MagSafe on here, according to the report, which is just bizarre. I guess if Apple's going for a radical change, they're going to get it in this design. But it made me wonder, you know, how does that work if you need to use an external drive and have charging at the same time, or you need to connect to a display and want to have an external drive connected at the same time? So I was a little bit confused by that until I saw an Apple Insider report. They seem to be a little bit more positive on the USB 3.1 Type-C connector. This is the latest revision of USB 3. I guess Apple and Intel have been working closely on this, much in the same way that they did with the Lightning connector, or the Thunderbolt connector, excuse me. And apparently a USB 3.1 Type-C connector would support 5K DisplayPort screens. It also offers higher watt power charging using USB alternative modes, which I guess are essentially enable it to carry both USB and non-USB signals over the same physical port. The Apple Insider report also claims that it can support up to four lanes of DisplayPort, and that higher watt power charging supports power wattages up to 100 watts. And they say that the power could power a hard drive without requiring a separate transformer or even a power cable going to the device. So that's positive for the connector. What's not clear, again, though, is how you might be able to do power and display over the single cable at the same time or have multiple devices. It wasn't clear if there was daisy chaining possibilities or if you're going to have to get some sort of hub. What's going on there wasn't really clear. I would imagine because it's USB, you'd have to go with some sort of hub solution. So maybe Apple's planning on doing some sort of docking solution for when you're back at your desktop and want to hook up an external display and maybe some additional drives. Again, everything's speculative at this point. We don't have a lot of details. There were, I guess, technically not a couple other ports, but at least some other kinds of input on the device. The rumor does say that it will have dual microphones on the side. And the other thing the report reiterated was something we had heard in the past, that was that Apple is going to redesign the touchpad on the Retina 12-inch MacBook Pro, or MacBook Air, rather, and it will be touch-only, removing the physical click mechanism, and that's supposedly so that they can get the design as thin as possible. And we had read that the design was probably not going to have the wedge shape of the current MacBook Airs. It was going to be more like the MacBook Pro design and will be able to be straight across. That's because it's also supposed to be fanless thanks to the new Broadwell Core M processors, which allow it to stay cooler and be more power efficient. They're not giving any kind of rumored release date at this point, but they do say that the Mac could be entering production as early as this month. And if that's the case, that means we could be seeing it in a couple months. Some folks think that Apple may wait and announce it sometime around WWDC in June. If they're already moving into production, that would seem a little bit late, but we're just going to have to take a wait and see. Now, I'm curious, after hearing this stuff, what do you think? Would you be happy with a 12-inch Retina MacBook Air with just one single port connector? It seems very limiting. So maybe Apple has some additional magic up their sleeve. Maybe they have a way to spin this that's going to make us think that this is a good idea. But just at first glance to me, it seems like a computer that I wouldn't want. I'm all for the ultra portability, but this seems like giving up a little bit too much. Apple finally started selling fully unlocked and carrier-free iPhones via its website in the U.S. this week. The 16, 64, and 128 gigabyte versions of the iPhone 6 are selling for $649, $749, and $849, respectively, with the iPhone 6 Plus versions going for $100 more. The T-Mobile version, of course, was always fully unlocked, but remember, you had to buy it, I believe, with a T-Mobile plan in place. I don't think you could walk into an Apple store and get it not without any kind of service plan. They didn't have a contract, but you still had to sign up for T-Mobile service. Of course, you could then take any SIM and put that inside your unlocked T-Mobile phone, but now they're selling it fully unlocked, not tied to any carrier. And speculation as to why they're finally making that available now is that Apple's new iPhones seem to have balanced out in terms of their availability almost everywhere. You can get one without delay, so Apple has kind of gotten to a point where they're able to meet demand with their supply, and that might be why they're now allowing fully unlocked systems through their retail channels. The iPhone, of course, is doing very well in terms of sales and continues to do well. We have latest numbers from Kantar World Panel Comtech, and they show that Apple's gaining market share thanks to the release of the new devices. They actually have sales data through the end of November that shows Apple gaining in every market except Japan. In the U.S., the iPhone accounted for 47.4% of sales. That was up 4.3% over 2013 numbers. The iPhone 6 alone accounted for 19% of total American smartphone sales. And in the U.K., Apple accounted for 42.5% of sales. And even in China, which is a market with a lot of device choices, including very cheap smartphones, Apple was actually able to gain 18.1% of the market. So that's good news for Apple in terms of sales numbers. In terms of predictions for the upcoming quarter, the December numbers are only likely going to show Apple's share continuing to grow bigger. The latest research from UBS predicts that Apple may have sold 69 million iPhones in the December quarter. That's well ahead of Wall Street predictions, which set the number around 65 million. Now, either of those numbers would obliterate Apple's previous all-time record, which was 51 million iPhones, and that happened in the holiday quarter of 2013. So it's looking to be a big quarter for Apple. As far as what the actual numbers are, we'll soon find out if the predictions are accurate, because Apple plans to hold its fiscal 2015 first quarter results call on January 27th, and that will cover that December holiday quarter. So we should have actual numbers. Staying on the predictions, though, UBS expects that Apple will announce total revenue of $68 billion. That would be up significantly from the $57.6 billion in revenue that they recorded a year ago. And then also, iOS 8 adoption continues to grow at a steady pace, along with the growth of iPhone sales. In Apple's latest App Store distribution report from January 5th, they noted that iOS 8 adoption has now reached 68%. That's good news for iOS 8, but the rate of adoption is still well behind the pace of iOS 7. iOS 7 actually reached nearly 80% adoption rate just a month after its release. I think it's been about 3 months or so since we've seen iOS 8 out, so well behind the iOS 7 numbers, but still good news for developers. As more and more people move into iOS 8, that's going to make things easier for software development, and that number should only continue to grow, I think, as folks upgrade their devices. But it does show that there's some hesitation this time around in upgrading, and I think we talked about on the last show, or the last couple shows, the fact that iOS 8 does have some warts, and I think that is impacting people and their desire to upgrade. Also, some of the edge case devices on the sort of it will run spec for iOS 8, they don't run all that well on the latest operating system. And a lot of people have had trouble with that. And so that starts getting talked about, that trickles down, and the average Joe hears that and says, you know, maybe I might skip this upgrade this time around and just wait till I upgrade to a new device. So I think as people reach the end of their contracts and they upgrade their devices, I think we'll see that iOS 8 number go up. And I would imagine by the time iOS 9 is ready to be announced, Apple will have more toward that 80%, 85% adoption rate of iOS 8. And then finally in the news for this week, I need to let you know about a bug in Spotlight's handling of mail previews that could reveal a little bit more information to email senders than you might like. This flaw was first reported by a German tech news site called Heiss and later confirmed by the IDG news service. The flaw has to do with the setting in mail for loading remote content and messages. That's an option that if you're the type of person and you don't want to have your emails tracked, so say you sign up for an email newsletter and you don't want them to be able to track opens or your email behavior, you're going to uncheck that because it's the thing that is often used with what's called a tracking pixel. So they'll put a little image on your embedded in the email, an invisible image, and then when that goes out and hits the sending mail servers or the sending person's servers, it will say, hey, so-and-so opened this email. And they can usually do things like track your IP address and get some additional information. So that's the thing when you open up your mail and you have to click the load images button to actually get the images to load. That's that extra little bit of security. So you can open up, say, a spam email, or if you accidentally have a spam email opened in the preview pane in your mail messages, it's not going to send an alert back to the spammer that you open the email and that you have a valid email address. So it prevents that harvesting of that kind of information when you read mail in mail.app. But the trouble with Spotlight apparently is that it ignores that remote content block preference in mail and actually loads the preview. And I think this may have been the way it has been for a while. I never really thought about it. But in essence, the problem is that if you use Spotlight to search your email and that little preview comes up in the Spotlight window, then that tracking pixel is triggered and it could send that information like your IP address, your OS version, your browser details, even the version of Quick Look that you're using. It sends that information back to that email server. And so this is really an issue of privacy. And, spammers have often used these tracking pixels, as I said before, to confirm that they have valid email addresses. So the risk here is that you do a Spotlight search, it hits that, and now the spammer goes, yep, I got you. I know that's a valid email address. I'm going to keep that on my list. And of course, spammers share their lists with other spammers, so you're going to get more email spam. So if you're really worried about this, for now, the best way to protect yourself until Apple actually fixes it would be to disable the Spotlight searching of your emails. It's relatively easy to do, if not inconvenient. I like to be able to search email from Spotlight. But if you are worried about this, go into System Preferences, uncheck the Mail and Messages option for the Spotlight preferences, and then you will be protected at least until Apple can issue a patch for this. It should be honoring that setting. Like I said, I don't know if it ever has, though. I'm trying to go back in my recent memory, and I recently upgraded to OS 10 Yosemite, so I can't confirm. So if you happen to know, let us know. Shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before I move on, I do want to take another quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Gazelle. If you're thinking about getting one of those new iPhone 6 or 6 Pluses, and it's a good time right now because they have availability, Gazelle actually wants to buy your current iPhone. They will give you cash for your iPhone, and you can use that cash for your upgrade. It's great. It's really an easy way to get cash. They give you a fair and upfront offer for your existing device, and they will even buy broken devices. And that's really what I love about Gazelle and why I like this service. They make the process of selling your used iPhone simple and hassle-free. All you have to do is go to the website gazelle.com, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com, search for your item, you tell Gazelle a little bit about the condition, and they will give you a risk-free offer right there on screen. When you accept it, they offer free shipping and in many cases even provide a box. And I use the box service every time I send back a device. It's great. They send you the box with a prepaid label. All you have to do is put your device in there, slap the label on, and it goes right back. And then once they receive your device, you get paid fast. You can get paid by check, by PayPal, or you can even opt for an Amazon gift card option, and they'll give you 5% more on your offer. So that's my favorite way to get paid by Gazelle, and it's fast and easy and quick. The offer process takes just a couple of minutes, so do it today, because every day you wait, your gadgets do lose value, and you can lock in your offer. So once you get your offer, you can lock it in. They'll give you time to even get your new device before you have to send in the old one, so you can make sure everything gets swapped over. You can erase your device, although Gazelle also handles doing that. So they'll get the device in, they'll make sure it's all cleaned off before it goes out back out into the world. And they've handled over 2 million trade-ins. They've paid out over $175 million to customers. And over 90% of people using Gazelle have reported having an excellent experience, and I'm included in that group. So what are you waiting for? Take a minute and find out what your iPhone's worth. Go to gazelle.com now to find out, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So I need to kick off with an important bit of follow-up from the last episode of the MacCast. I was reporting on some posts about a number that Tim Cook likes to use in Apple's results calls to show how happy Apple customers are with their products. It's called the Customer Satisfaction Index. And last week I told you that Apple's number came in the latest round at 79, slipping below their competitor, Samsung, who was at 81. So Tim Cook always liked to say Apple has the highest customer sat number of any smartphone maker. And right now, that is not true, or seemed to not be true. Well, Chuck sent me an email and pointed out that the numbers that were quoted just last week or a couple weeks ago were actually from May 2014. So I think I had mentioned that I thought maybe some of the issues were due to iOS 8 and maybe some of the frustrations people were having there. But since the numbers came out in May of 2014, that would mean that iOS 8 wasn't even out yet. So that couldn't account for the change. 9 to 5 Mac, which I think was the source of the report, actually did note on their site that May was the date of the report. I don't know if I missed that before or if they updated their article. I don't remember it being there before I put it in my show notes, but I could have just missed it, so I apologize for that, and I wanted to clarify it, and thank you, Chuck, for keeping us in check. But now I'm even more curious about that number. Why did Apple's customer satisfaction rate slip in May of 2014? I'm trying to rack my brain to think of theories, but I'm guessing that that won't be a number we hear on the next quarterly results call. And I guess they only update this number once a year. The overall customer satisfaction index for everything they track, I guess, is updated quarterly, which is why the latest quarterly report came out, and I think this story surfaced again. But just wanted to give clarification on that number so that nobody gets confused. The other thing that I talked about on the last episode of the MacCast was the curious situation where Apple had apparently removed the iCloud photo app from iCloud.com. And the main reason that was curious is that if you're using the iCloud photo library feature on iOS, that's where you can have all of your photos stored in the iCloud service. So not just the photo stream, but everything that you might have in the Photos app. The only way you could add items to that from your Mac, because Apple hasn't released the Photos app for the Mac yet, was by going to iCloud.com and using an app that Apple had set up there. Well, they pulled that down, and there wasn't really a reason given for Apple why, but part of my speculation was, well, maybe they're getting ready to finally release the Photos app for OS X Yosemite. That turned out not to be the case. And as a matter of fact, many of you tweeted me not long after, just a couple days after I had dropped that episode of the MacCast, to let me know that I was completely crazy and that you still had access to the Photos app on iCloud.com. Well, I may be crazy, but that's not the reason why I'm crazy, because actually what happened was a couple days after they pulled it, and maybe just a day or so after I released that episode of the MacCast, Apple put the iCloud Photos app back on iCloud.com. So at the moment, this is still the only way that on a Mac you can add or view items in your iCloud photo library. Hopefully, Apple will be releasing, I think they had said that they were going to do it in early 2015, released the Photos app for OS X Yosemite. So we should get an update. And that app is going to have a little bit of controversy around it. So I'm sure we'll be talking about it on future episodes of the MacCast, because it's actually going to replace Aperture and iPhoto. So it's going to be that sort of merging of those two things. And we've talked about that on prior shows. So stay tuned for that. Now, as I said at the top of the show, I was very excited to hear some of the HomeKit news coming out of CES, especially considering that overall, this year's Consumer Electronics Show, and I think that's still what they're calling it, the news coming out of that seemed pretty underwhelming this year. We heard a lot about ultra-high-definition television, something that I'm not all that excited about. I barely just entered the HD TV market in the past couple years. There were also some things with self-driving cars that was pretty cool. I think there was some announcements with some CarPlay systems, but for us Apple fans, there wasn't a whole lot to get excited about out of CES, except for one thing: the sheer number of HomeKit compatible products that were announced. I was very excited to see some of our favorite companies announcing HomeKit products. That would be companies like Belkin, iHome, Incipio, GridConnect, iDevices, Withings, and Elgato. Also, other companies that, you know, aren't typically in the Mac market, companies like Insteon, which is a whole home automation system. They've been around in the home automation space for a long time. They announced HomeKit support, which is exciting. Schlage door locks, Chamberlain garage doors. So we're going to be hooking up a lot of stuff to our iDevices, and by proxy then via HomeKit, which means that we're going to be able to get all of these products to work together, and we're going to have quick and easy setup. That's what's most exciting to me about HomeKit, because it really brings home automation to the masses. In the past, if you've heard my shows with Ara Derderian about doing home automation on the Mac, you really had to do a lot of cobbling together of stuff. Getting things connected and talking to each other was a little bit tricky. There was a lot of scripting involved, probably with some Apple script if you really wanted to automate things. And HomeKit is set to solve all of that. First and foremost, as far as setup, all of these products are going to use Bluetooth or Wi-Fi to tap into your home network. So you're just going to have to, you know, basically plug them in, and it'll walk you through a quick setup process to get it connected and locked into your network and into HomeKit. We've had products like the Nest that do this in a way, but one of the limitations of that is that it really didn't talk to anything else. It sort of talks to its app, and it doesn't talk to any other part. It doesn't really become part of a cohesive smartphone. It's been challenging or next to impossible to get that to work. Sure, there were clever kind of hackarounds, things like if this, then that integration, but the average person really isn't going to bother with that. And ultimately, I think what we really want is we want that Star Trek experience in our home, right? We want to be able to say, computer, set the ambient light levels to 45%, or computer, I'm watching a movie, and then have everything sort of activate, have your sound system turn on, have it go to the right viewing settings on your TV, all these sorts of things. Maybe turn down the lights to a certain percentage, and even fire up the popcorn maker, who knows? And with HomeKit support and all these devices, we're going to get much, much closer to that reality. Now, I may be getting ahead of myself a little bit, as you'll hear in a little bit, but let's talk about, you know, some of these devices. They have their own apps, of course, for setup and configuration, but the real magic happens when they are all enabled via HomeKit. And that's what was exciting, is all the vendors announcing, yes, we have these home automation devices, and they're going to work with HomeKit. And that's because HomeKit can actually communicate with Siri, meaning that you can do voice control and voice functions, just like that Star Trek scenario I mentioned a second ago. So any HomeKit devices that have mics built in could also communicate back to Siri. So you could do Siri on your phone if you have your phone with you and control things, but some of these products and devices actually are going to have mics built in, and if they're on the same network with your iPhone, they can communicate back to Siri from the actual smart home device, which is just really cool to think about. So you could have devices in every room. You might not even have to have your phone on you, and you could still do voice control. And even outside the house, this is going to work apparently if you have a newer Apple TV, because it can work as a hub to work with your HomeKit devices when you're away. This information came out of The Verge, and I guess they're saying right now it's the only way that you can get HomeKit and Siri working outside of your home network. Inside your home network, they'll work together just fine, but if you want to be able to do outside control, it's going to have to gain access through an Apple TV. Apple Insider actually reported back in October that Apple had added in their Apple TV software beta 2, which I think is an update only for the Apple TV 3, that they added support for testing HomeKit with iOS apps, and that's how this is all working at this point. It's not clear if only an Apple TV will be able to do this. Obviously, HomeKit's not out there yet. The devices aren't deployed. And I guess Apple could possibly add HomeKit support to their AirPort software, for example, and put it into their AirPort hardware as well. But as of right now, the only device that we know is an Apple TV with the Beta 2 software running on it. But I think the cool news is that once you have your devices installed and you have them integrated with HomeKit, you can start to really do true home automation. HomeKit will allow you to create these things called scenes that allow these devices to work together. So you can actually script things. For example, maybe you could set up something where when you leave the house, say by opening the garage door and then driving away, there could be a geofence that could trigger and say, oh, okay, I saw the garage door open. I saw your car move away from the house, or you move away from the house. So you're driving away. It could then trigger the doors to lock and the lights to turn off and the thermostat to lower down. And then it could even do the opposite when you return home. So when it sees you approaching and then the garage door opens, those sorts of things. And it solves that complex setup problem, right? You just connect the device, you connect to the network and connect to HomeKit and you're good to go. You don't need to worry about different standards, different devices, different manufacturers, as long as they say that they have HomeKit support. And that's the real true magic, in my opinion. So you get this sort of customized solution that fits your needs, right? You can go out and you can buy different devices from different manufacturers. You can buy the ones that fit your lifestyle and ignore the ones that you don't need. So maybe you want lighting controls and a thermostat, but you're not really interested in automatic door locks or security cams. Doesn't matter. And if you change your mind at some point and you say, you know what, I think I want to add door locks into my system, you can have choice. You don't have to buy the Schlage one or the one from Kwikset or whoever it might be. You can pick and choose, again, as long as it has HomeKit integration, and know that you can plug it into your system and you're going to be able to control it all through HomeKit. So that's a benefit to consumers. It's also great because it allows companies to play to their strengths. For example, Schlage can keep focusing on door locks and they don't have to get into the whole home automation business just to, you know, build a system that works. And so I really think this is really exciting. Another thing I read about was that once you have all the HomeKit devices hooked up in your house, you can even ask Siri what HomeKit devices are nearby, and she can tell you the kinds of things that you can control and what you can do with your system. So it's really voice interactive. It sounds like it's going to be innovative and amazing. And there were a lot of these HomeKit products and HomeKit promises made at CES. And while I'm optimistic, I'm also a little bit cautious because HomeKit still is in development. It's not fully fleshed out quite yet. And a lot of the folks making announcements even alluded to this. As a matter of fact, Apple just started its made for eye certifications for HomeKit devices. So I think very few or none of the devices that we saw showed off at CES actually have a certification yet. They're submitting to Apple right now. So hopefully those certifications and approvals will be coming soon. And we don't know when the products are actually going to hit the streets. Now, it's likely going to be sometime in the second quarter if you're a betting person, but some vendors were saying that they were hoping to ship their products this quarter. I'm assuming that means if they can get the certification from Apple. And at the very least, though, I think 2015 is going to be a big year for HomeKit, and it's something I've been looking forward to for a long time, this whole promise of doing full voice-activated, voice-controlled home automation. And I think it's going to be here. The question is going to be, how well is it going to work in version 1? I'm sure there's going to be some bumps and hiccups and some things we have to work through. But right now, it's seeming very promising, and I'm pretty excited about it. This week, I received a curious email from Larry, who asked me this question. How do you stop applications from opening in their own windows? I now have to swipe to see them. I don't like that feature, and it just started for me yesterday, and I'm not sure how, but there must be a way to turn it off, and I just can't find it. And I have to admit that this stumped me a little bit, because I'm thinking, well, apps have always opened up in their own windows, but then I started thinking about the whole swipe to see them, and it made me realize that I think, Larry, what's going on is you probably have your apps in full screen mode. And I think the way this probably happened without you noticing it is because of a change that we've talked about in the past but might have gotten missed. I think it's a subtle change that Apple made in OS X Yosemite, and it's not really clear for a lot of folks. And if you've been using the Mac for a long time, you can easily stumble across it because it's a change with the behavior of the little green stoplight button. So you know the window buttons, the red, yellow, green, we call them the stoplights up in the upper left-hand corner of your windows. Well, the green one in the past always was a maximize button. So you would tap on that, right, and your window would maximize on your screen. Well, now in OS X Yosemite, Apple changed the default behavior of that to make your application go into full screen mode. And when you have multiple applications in full screen mode, you then need to use a swipe gesture. It's a three-finger swipe on the trackpad or a two-finger swipe on your mouse pad to switch between views. So I think that's what you're talking about when you say, oh, my applications are opening in their own window or actually on their own screen, and now I have to swipe to see them. I'm hoping I'm getting that right, and I'm hoping this fix is going to help you. But once you've done that, you have to switch either using the swipe gesture, or you can also click on the icon in the dock. And if you click on the icon in the dock, it'll slide between screens. And with a full screen app, you do have to move your cursor to the edge of the screen to actually have the dock appear. So if you're like me, it's obvious when you go into full screen mode because I always have my dock visible. I don't like the auto-hide feature. But if you're using the auto-hide feature, you might not notice that anything is wrong. And so to get things back to normal, Larry, oh, and the other thing I should mention is once you've put an app into full screen mode, if you quit it from the full screen mode, it will remember that state. So that means the next time that you go to relaunch the application, it will open up back in full screen mode or in its own window, as you called it. And I'm guessing that's what happened. I'm guessing that somehow you maybe did a maximize at some point, you didn't notice it, you quit the app, and now you're launching the application and it's launching into full screen mode. To get it back out, it's pretty easy. In the app that's in full screen mode, just put your cursor near the top of the screen. That will bring up the menu bar and the window title bar, and then you can just click the little green stoplight button again, and it should exit full screen mode. You can also control full screen mode from the view menu. There's an enter full screen and an exit full screen option depending upon what you're doing. And of course, there's a keyboard shortcut as well. Command Control F will toggle full screen mode in an application on or off. Now, unfortunately, in OS X Yosemite, there's not a way to change the little green stoplight functionality back to the old behavior where it does maximize by default. But luckily, there's some alternatives that I can let you know about that might help. If you hold down the Option key when clicking on the little stoplight button, it will actually force it back into the maximize mode. And you can actually verify this by holding down the Option key and hovering over the icon. If you don't have the Option key held down, what you'll notice is you'll see the little double arrow icon when you hover over it, indicating that it's going to enter full screen mode. If you hold down the Option key, that will change to the little plus symbol, indicating that it's going to work in the maximize mode. And then something new I just learned when I was looking up how to kind of get around this. Apparently, you can also double-click the title bar in OS X Yosemite. And I don't know if this works in Mavericks, but if you double-click in the title bar area in some applications, it will maximize and unmaximize a window. I'm not sure if this works in every app, but it does work in, say, the Finder, for example. So, Larry, hopefully that is what happened to you, and hopefully this offers up a solution or some fixes for you. If it doesn't, just shoot me another email, and we'll try and get you sorted out. But I think we probably got it. Another subject that has come up on the MacCast from time to time and came up again this week is missing hard drive space. This week, Charles is struggling with it, and it's after buying a new 4-terabyte drive to replace a 3-terabyte one that was filling up. The 3-terabyte drive, according to Charles, had 370 gigabytes of free space on it, and after getting his new drive, formatting it, cloning the data over from the 3-terabyte drive to the 4-terabyte drive, he noticed he only had 700 gigabytes of free disk space, and it should have been closer to 1.3 terabytes, as you would expect, or he would expect. Unfortunately, I did some back and forth with Charles and wasn't able to help. We couldn't pin down his issues, so I'm sort of throwing it out to the community. Has anybody run across this where you buy a new larger drive, you clone everything over, and for whatever reason, you don't have the amount of free disk space that you were expecting? But what I wanted to share with you is a couple of the tips and tricks that I asked him to try out, some places to look where that storage might have actually gone to and you might not have noticed, and maybe it'll help some of you out if you've noticed sort of missing hard drive space. And the first place I think to check is your Time Machine local snapshots. A lot of people don't know about this, but Time Machine has a feature. If you're using Time Machine specifically, it's usually with a notebook or a laptop, and you disconnect from your Time Machine drive, Time Machine is still going to try and run on its schedule, and it is going to make backups. If there's enough extra free space on your drive, it's going to make backups, temporary backups or snapshots to your internal hard drive so that it can continue to do its thing. It can continue to have its Time Machine history. And then when you get back, it will pick back up with your Time Machine drive. But while it's disconnected, it might actually create these backups. And the way you can see them is if you go into the Apple menu to About This Mac and then click on the Storage tab, look at your hard drive, and there's that little sort of bar chart, and it's in different colors. If you see a backups section, then you know you have some of these local Time Machine snapshots. And the rules for setting these up are if you're away from your Time Machine drive and you have the disk space, it will run this backup. So they'll only run if you have a certain amount of free disk space. And then once your drive starts filling up or reaching the limits of that free disk space, that controls how Time Machine is going to sort of clean up or remove these snapshots. So what will happen is once you end up with less than 20% of available disk space, total disk space, Time Machine is going to start removing these snapshots, starting with the oldest one first. If your startup disk free space falls below 10% of the total available space, or is less than 5 gigabytes, then it's going to start removing those snapshots at a faster rate or a higher priority. And if it's not able to free up enough disk space to give you at least 10% disk space free, or if it gets above that 5 gigabyte threshold, it's actually going to remove all of the snapshots except for the most current one and stop creating those snapshots. So if you only have 5 gigabytes left on your drive, it's not going to be doing snapshots anymore. Or if you only have 10% free, it's not going to be doing snapshots anymore. Now, if you don't like these being there and you actually want to flush them out, so if you go look in the About menu and you see this stuff and you're like, I want to clear off that space, probably the easiest way to do it, you can go digging through your system and find these and delete them, but probably the easiest way to do it is just to toggle Time Machine off temporarily, reboot your machine, and then turn it back on. So you go into System Preferences, you go into Time Machine, set the Time Machine switch to off, and don't worry, that's not going to delete your Time Machine backups that you already have. It's just going to temporarily disable Time Machine so it won't create any new ones. But after doing that, close the Time Machine window, restart your Mac. That will clear out the snapshots, the local snapshots, And then when your system comes back on, you can, again, go into the About menu. You shouldn't see that backup section anymore. That's how you'll know they got cleared out. And then just go back into System Preferences and turn Time Machine back on. Now, if you disconnect from your Time Machine drive and you're out and about, it's going to start doing those backups again unless you have Time Machine disabled. So just be aware of that. But you can go through and periodically clean these up. Frankly, I would say don't even bother with that, though, because Time Machine is going to manage itself. You really don't need to worry about it. And as I mentioned earlier, it's going to clean up the disk space when it needs it, and you can get that space back. It's kind of like space that's being temporarily used by Time Machine, but it's available to you to use as well. So it's not going to prevent you from writing out files or doing any of that sort of stuff. So I'm telling you this mostly so that you're aware of the feature, you know how to look at it and see how much storage it's using. But after this, I think you can just kind of forget about it and just file it in the back of your mind. The other thing to do if you're running out of disk space is maybe to seek out some older files and, you know, move those to an archive, back them up off onto an external disk, or just look through your system and see if you have any really large files that you maybe forgot about that are eating up your disk space. You know, it's always a good idea to do a little bit of house cleaning. It's also always a good idea before you do that house cleaning to make sure that you have a backup. So don't do any of the stuff that I'm about to recommend without having a backup first. And I would say anything that you're planning on removing off of your internal drive to free up space, I would also create an archive of it, or at least think about it. Is this something you're going to need back at some point? Can you create an archive, say, off onto an external drive or onto a USB thumb drive or maybe onto something like a Drobo or a Synology disk station? That you can have for reference. And that's pretty much what I do with my system. For example, all of the Maccast audio files, those take up a lot of storage space. So obviously I don't have 512 episodes of Maccast audio on my internal hard drive. I don't have the space for that. So that stuff gets archived automatically, and then I periodically go through, clean that out, house clean my system, and get those files off to free up my disk space. So one of the tools that I use for that that's really helpful is an application called Daisy Disk. And this will go through, it will analyze your entire hard drive, and then it gives you a visual map to show you where the large files are. So you can go through there, you can drill down, you can identify where your big files are, and maybe figure out, oh, okay, I totally forgot about that movie that I had installed there, or had in my documents folder, in my movies folder, that's eating up, you know, 8 gigabytes of space. I don't need that there anymore. I can delete it, or I can archive it, something like that. Daisy Disk is a paid for application. There's also a free application called Grand Perspective. A couple of others that can help you do this house cleaning, Omni Disk Sweeper or Clean My Mac 2. There's tons of other tools. If you just do a little search on the App Store, I'm sure you can find some, but I particularly like Daisy Disk. I think visually it's really nice and it works really well. And I don't unfortunately remember the price, but I don't think it was that expensive. Clean My Mac 2 can also go through and remove things like your user cache files, your system cache files, and your log files. I think this is also something that Onyx and Cocktail can do as well. And so you may want to go through there. I think I ran Clean My Mac 2 a couple weeks ago, and I found several gigs of cache files and log files that it was able to clean up. I think like 5 gigabytes of information. And so you can remove that stuff. Just be aware, because they're cache files and log files, they'll start to build back up again. So this is a periodic house cleaning that you may or may not want to do, and just something worth looking into. So that's a couple ideas on how to get back some missing disk space, or find some disk space that looks like it may have gone missing. And I hope you find that helpful. I received an email from Brian, and Brian is like me and maybe like you and likes to rent movies on iTunes. I'm more and more actually renting movies on iTunes. And if you start renting movies on iTunes, one thing that you're probably going to notice right away when you're browsing films, be it on the Apple TV or in the iTunes store, is that you'll find movies that are only available for sale and aren't available for renting. And that can be very frustrating if you're looking for something to rent. And so Brian sent me this email, and he was wondering if there was a way to, in iTunes or in the iTunes store, to just see the movies that are available for rental. And back in the day, so Brian, what I remember is back in the day, there was a feature in iTunes called Power Search. And Power Search offered some more advanced controls and some more advanced filtering, some more advanced ways to actually search inside of iTunes. And I immediately thought about this and thought, well, just use the Power Search. So I went into iTunes 12, and of course, iTunes 12 has that radical design change. And I don't know when the Power Search feature went away, but I could not find it anywhere in there. The redesign seems to have obliterated it or made it non-existent. And I say seems to have because actually there's still a way to get at the Power Search feature. And I think this is your solution, or as a matter of fact, I know this is your solution. Because for those of you who don't know, the iTunes Store is basically a big giant web app. Right? You go to the iTunes Store and you're basically loading a web page inside iTunes 12. And there is still the URL that works that will access the Power Search feature. You just need to know what the URL is. And I will have that URL in the show notes at maccast.com. It's way too long to read off. But once you click this link, what it'll do is it will launch iTunes, go to the iTunes Store, and load the Power Search interface. So it still exists. And in the first box, you can search all the different kinds of content. So in your case, Brian, what you're going to want to do is pick movies as the search criteria. And when you do that, you'll immediately see all of these boxes and options that you can fill in that you can't do with a normal search on the iTunes Store. So one of the key ones for what we're talking about is at the bottom, you can check the box that says search only for movies available to rent. And then if you just click search, if that's the only thing that you check and you just click search, then it will give you search results for only movies on the iTunes Store that are rentable. That's a little bit hard to browse because I think it gives you them in terms of release date. But very often, I know I'm only looking for the newest releases that I can rent. If you want to filter it a little bit more, you could put in a year. So there's a way to search movies by year. So check the box, rent only, search for the year, say 2014, and it's only going to show rentals that were released in 2014. And you can further search and filter and put in additional criteria. And there are lots of other options in Power Search that I think can be handy, not just for finding only movies available for rent, but for doing other things. For example, you can search by actor or search by director. If you're searching for apps, you can... There's a checkbox and you can have it only show you free apps. So if you're looking for a particular functionality or an app that does a specific thing, but you only want to find the free versions of the apps, that's right in there in the Power Search. So it's a really handy tool. I wish Apple gave you an easier way to get access to it. Luckily, if you want to build your own easy access inside iTunes, you can do that. The great site Doug's Scripts, and if you've never heard of Doug's Scripts before, I've talked about it in the past. It's a site, they offer all kinds of Apple scripts and Apple script training. So they can show you how to do all kinds of things with different applications using Apple script. But they do have a script that you can write, an example that you can put into the script editor, and you can build your own Power Search link to add into the Apple script menu in iTunes. It's really simple. It's just a couple lines. They actually have a downloadable version, so you can just download the script and just drop it into your iTunes scripts, Apple scripts, and it'll show right up there in the menu. And it basically just gives you quick access from iTunes to the Power Search feature. So I immediately added it to iTunes 12, and now I just go to the Apple script menu, and it says search iTunes Power Search. And away I go and I can access it. So, Brian, I hope that helps you out. It'd be great if there was more of a way to browse through that rental content, but I haven't found a way to do that. If you happen to know if there is a way to do that, something that we didn't think of, let us know, maccast@gmail.com, and we'll try and follow up on the next episode of the MacCast. And then the last thing for today is my thing of the moment. This is a new feature that I think I kicked off last episode where I realized, you know, I don't do formal reviews on the MacCast, but I do have apps and products and things that I find from time to time that I find interesting. So I don't know if we'll do this on every episode, but if I've happened to start using a product or start using an application over the past week that I think you might find handy or useful, I'm going to just cover it in this section. So what I have this week is I ordered over the Christmas holiday, finally, a pencil from 53. And this is the iPad iOS stylus by 53. These are the folks that do the app Paper by 53. And I was actually worried that I may or may not like it. Now, our friend Jeff Gamet from the Mac Observer and my co-host, or one of my co-hosts on the iOS show, absolutely loves the pencil. I was worried about it because it has this soft rubber tip, and I tend to not like the rubber-tipped styluses. I have a Pogo Sketch Pro, and it's okay, but I was never really thrilled with it. I never felt that the feel of the tip on the screen flowed that well, so I was worried about that. I was also very worried that the pencil is really chunky. It's kind of got a rectangular format, and it's big and chunky. Looks like a big drafting pencil, so it doesn't roll around. I think it's flat, so it doesn't roll off of your surfaces, which is actually handy. I worried because big fat tip, it can sometimes be hard to see what you're drawing. The tip actually gets in the way. Well, it turns out I didn't have any of those issues using the pencil by 53 with the Paper app. It actually slides very nicely on the screen. Works really, really well. I don't know if they've done some things in software, but I can use it just fine. It seems to be very accurate in terms of where I'm touching on the screen and where it's actually drawing. So I've had no issues on that side of things. It's really interesting how the design works because to charge it, you pull on the tip and the core and battery slide out of the actual casing. And then there's a USB connector built right into the battery that you plug in for charging. So you charge it up. And then you slide it back in. The tip is also interchangeable. So that soft rubber tip, I guess, can wear out eventually, depending on how much you use it. But you can order just additional tips and put those back in. Using it with the Paper app, obviously, it's designed for that. So it's super simple. You just tap and hold on this little area, and it automatically pairs up. I've had no issues with it unpairing or not being paired to the application. And once you have a pencil and you've paired it with the app, it unlocks some additional features. So you can get the blend feature, which allows you, when you're not using the pencil, you can use your finger on the screen. Rather than actually drawing now, it will actually blend colors together so you can get nice smooth gradients and things like that. I really like that feature. The pencil also allows you to do what they call surface pressure. It's, as I said, got a big, fat, kind of triangular wedge-shaped tip. What the surface pressure does is it means that when you're using just the tip of the device, it's going to do a thinner line. And as you angle it down to the wider edge of that rubber, it will actually give you a wider stroke. So, for example, if you're using the pencil, you can use the pencil edge to kind of fill in big, wide areas with a big, wide stroke. It also has an eraser end, so when you flip it around and you use the eraser end, it actually erases items on the screen, and using the pencil, once it's activated, it triggers the palm rejection, so you can actually put your palm on the screen, slide it around, and it's not going to make any marks. It's only going to detect the tip of the pencil. Occasionally, I've had it misdetect when I'm using the palm rejection, so it might trigger an eraser or a blend stroke when I'm actually using the pencil, but that hasn't happened too frequently. Not too worried about that. And overall, I'm just loving it. I love the material, too. I ordered the one that's walnut, so it's actually real wood in terms of the casing. They also have a graphite aluminum version if you prefer more of the metal style. And it's fabulous. It works with other applications as well. So obviously it works very well with Pencil by 53 or with Paper by 53, but it does have an API, and it looks like some other app developers are integrating support. So Sketchbook, Procreate, NoteShelf, which is one of my favorite handwritten note-taking applications on the iPad. I'm excited to try it out with that, and it looks like very soon they're going to be adding support for some of Adobe's apps, including Adobe Photoshop Sketch. So I'm really liking the pencil as a stylus, especially if you use the Paper by 53 app. As far as pricing goes, it's US $59.95 if you want the walnut wood version, and I think it's $49.95 if you get the metal version. And you can get that through the 53.com website. I think I ordered mine through Amazon.com, so you can also find it at other retailers as well. And that's my thing of the moment. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with Text Expander Touch and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial by going to lynda.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They're at BackbeatMedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, a response to something that you heard on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can send me email and audio comments, shoot those to maccast@gmail.com. That's the email address. If you prefer to do audio and you want to leave a voicemail, you can call the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, and you can leave voicemail there. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. We also have the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. And the MacCast Google Plus community, just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you will find us there. But with that, that's going to do it for this episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.